much. I think we're fully over an hour past schedule, and we could all just gather at a nice wine bar or something and discuss this. But I'll try to go relatively quickly, because what I want to do is sort of expand the conversation outside of the temporal period of the present, but still, in some ways, talk about the Anthropocene. And I'll try to give you some highlights from some public intellectuals, Lewis Mumford, J.D. Bernal, and Johnny von Neumann, by way of sort of mid-20th century perspectives on our technological situation. And I'm tempted to do this in about 5 minutes, but Sebastian said go ahead for 30 if you'd put up with me. And I know we're late, so do I have your permission?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm sorry to the translators, I might wander away a little bit from the script. And I think, although scientists have yet to acknowledge officially the age of the Anthropocene, that's coming in 2016, humanists have eagerly embraced it, but have not always clarified the concept. For some, the age of humans is more than a concept, it's a game changer, something sounding the death knell on physical limits and signifying the final chapter of what may be the decisive epoch of our planet. And as you can see from the deep color reds that we're portraying here today, this is very serious stuff. It seems like the plot almost of a science fiction novel, perhaps Jules Verne, Earth's axis altering sans dessous dessous, or Olaf Stapleton's macro-historical Last and First Men. What does it mean for humanity to be moving from the age of geologists called the Holocene, where the historical records originated, to the Anthropocene, where it seems we humanity, may meet our demise? Are there multiple Anthropocenes? Some argue that human influence began first with the hunting to extinction of the large Pleistocene mammals, or to the onset of early agriculture about 8,000 years ago. That is, some would argue that we've been living with human influence at a very large scale for a long time, but the Anthropocene of Paul Crutzen dates to the Age of Revolution, especially the Industrial Revolution, although social scientists and humanists are interested in the political revolutions at that time, of the 19th century, which accompanied worldwide colonization and the onset of industrial effluence. And then there's the recent radioactive horizon post-Hiroshima, in which the atomic age and then the great acceleration of exponential trends of population pollution and resource depletion. And this is the turning the corner on very fast growth and fast demise of certain biological diversity and greenhouse gases, and alludes to the earlier talks about Al Gore's high lift. And even there's even more recent ones, for example, 1970 with the widespread dawning of environmental consciousness around Earth Day, and then even 1990, the widespread dawning of environmental apprehension after Jim Hansen says the global warming has begun. So you have, again, an exponential rise after 1990 of this kind of literature. And I think of humanist activity surrounding the Anthropocene. But it's a long time issue. Our attention is inevitably drawn to the 21st century, the one we live in, the one we work in, and the one we play in. And so I'll just show a couple slides. The classic, or one of the depictions of this is all the exponentials, and they have some color coding in here with the reds on this side, again, to emphasize, I guess, the fear factor. Science had always been published in black and white except for a little bit of geography and sort of Audubon's kind of birds and things. But now science is always in color, and we're finding new color reds, thanks to Bridget Schneider, who's been informing me about the color red. But here's the great, it's called the Great Acceleration, and that's our current contemporary dating of anthropogenic turning the corners. And so I have a thesis I'm working on called the Interventionist Anthropocene, in which we don't just bother to fix the sky, but we fix everything. And so that's my Fixing the Sky cover. It does have some color coding there, but that's from 1954, from the cover of Collier's magazine, in which the technocrat is controlling rain, it's clear. There's all kinds of things encoded into that leverage that we could have over climate. So I made a paper recently that said we can provide images of climate control, mainly through the cartoons of levers and and sulfate cannons and space mirrors and the kind of technologies that might change the planetary temperature. But we can't truly, and I'm agreeing with the earlier speakers, we can't always visualize climate that well. And so carbon dioxide is not visible to our eyes. Is there a technological fix for everything? It's kind of my question. The Anthropocene conjures up grandiose, numerous, and largely unexplored concepts. It opens creative space for practical and playful cultural interventions. But when was it, and what are its visual cultures? And is there a singular it? What images and imaginations can help stimulate our thinking? And here, I took the role of historian, not necessarily a fan of macro history or big history, the kind of history that starts with the Big Bang and ends up with the 21st century, but I'm interested in big picture history, a history that's framed, that might have a good story to tell, have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so my new work is on that kind of big picture history. It's both a history of science and technology. It spans two world wars and the Cold War, focusing on the period 1900 to 1960. And it goes from basically Marconi wireless to Tyro satellite and the moment in which the Laplacian program of perfect observation and perfect prediction kind of ran into a brick wall called Ed Lorenz. And so it's a nice frame, it's a framed picture of with warm body protagonists. So the protagonists are Wilhelm Bjerknes, his student Carl Rossby, and his student Harry Wexler. And the trajectories go from Sweden through all kinds of different cities. Actually, it starts in Paris, where Wilhelm, as a young Wilhelm, comes to the Electrical Exposition, and he meets people like Hertz, and he meets people like, he gets enamored of Maxwell's equations and brings that into fluid mechanics. So it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and the beginning is really when the Laplacian program became a geophysical fluid dynamics in approximately 1900, and the end of the story for me is when Ed Lorenz gives his first paper saying, you really can't predict that, you really can't do that. On the way, there's some cracks in the wall. Henri Poincaré said, you can't measure nature precisely. And there's some steps along the way that tells a story, but most of it is a story of excitement as the airplanes go up, the radio balloons go up, the rockets go up, the radar is invented, and they have all kind of tools to look into the atmosphere up through digital computing and eventually to the satellite going around the world. So I'm going to go quickly through, because I think you're probably familiar with this, and I'll offer anyone that emails me, I'll give you the text of my paper because it has some nuance that I won't be able to do now in lieu of the pending wine party that we're having at, and so I'll start with, I think the next slide. Oh, this is just about technology. I think it's important to define it. It's not identified. Often it's thrown out there as a term, but I think defining it's important, and you can read faster than I can talk about it. Sorry about that. I don't know what the future is. I know something about the past, and I would return to the past as a guide to try to bring in some new categories to think about these things. And so I quote Gibbon. Lewis Mumford's my first public intellectual, and of course, in his Technics and Civilization, he talked about big macro periods in history that I think we could go through relatively quickly. Somebody asked me once when did humans become concerned about climate, and I didn't say 1992. I said in the Pleistocene, because we are an ice age species, and our history is all written in the Holocene. And so the era was very far before the Common Era. The energy of our species, and we had the current cranial capacity we have today, but we used muscle power, stone and bone tools, and the metaphor for the whole era was just survival. We might be getting back to that metaphor again for the 21st century, but for that it was survival against the climate and predators and shelter and things like that. So the image, here's the first IPCC meeting, and they're wondering why it got so cold so quickly. And Mumford goes through this. He talks about different paleo technologies. But his real first era, Mumford's real first era, is what he called the EO, the dawn of techniques. And so EO techniques is wind and water and animal power, civilization setting up on riverine environments and at the fall lines of major streams, and using metals, metalworking, woodworking, cloth and leather. A sort of a metaphor for this is the clipper ship. It's really quite a high technology. Just yesterday, I went to a concert, noontime concert, with just a violin, and it was fantastic. But the violin's made out of wood. The violinist was playing so quickly he broke like three or four or five of his horsehairs, and he was just doing Romani, I guess was the name of the music, kind of gypsy music. You can circumnavigate the globe in the Eocene. Everything you built could potentially turn back into recyclable compost. And so the metaphors for that period are agriculture and artisans. These people lived in technospheres. They lived a full and rich lives, sometimes documented lives, in which they were immersed, and their categories came from the technosphere in which they lived. He has, again, if you go back to techniques and civilization, there's an odd period called the paleotechnic, and this hangs us all up. It's the development of energy sources for the steam engine. So the dating of the Anthropocene, for the classical dating of it, goes back to the beginning of industrialization and the emission of fossil fuels. The materials of coal and steel, the artifact of choice, I had several choices, but this was the iron horse, sort of characterizing the age of steel, pretty much epitomized in the 19th century through industry and very visible pollution. Today, our pollution's invisible. If we could color the CO2 molecules, we'd be better off, maybe, at least for public awareness. But the visible pollution of smoke, coal smoke, was a real metaphor for the age of production. Now, again, the stuff I was telling you about radio sons and Marconi and all that stuff really comes from Mumford's next period called the Neotechnic. And if you think about it, 1900 is a pretty big watershed because we began to live in an electromagnetic environment. We've always had sunlight and radio waves from outer space, but we began to manipulate them and use them and send messages across the Atlantic and use the kind of wireless and eventually radio technologies. And so for Mumford, the energy sources were electricity, oil, and nuclear. He didn't say nuclear, but I kind of added that. Aluminum and plastics were his light creative materials so that the architects could make soaring buildings. Some of the airplane fuselages were aluminum. And then we have, Dustin Hoffman's friend said in The Godfather, plastics, you know. Make sure you get into plastics, young man. And we had the disposable society. I have lots of pictures of plastic, but I didn't bring any with me. But the artifact, one of the artifacts of this could be the mass production of automobiles. It could also be a large, something like a B-52 bomber carrying all the all the infrastructure of the neotechnic. And Mumford really liked the neotechnic. He lived in that period. He flourished in the 1930s through 50s. And he liked to think about moving quickly and building lightly and having this kind of society that was high tech with my metaphor for it being mass consumption, mass production as well. But it puts us into the last categorization of the Anthropocene, the period of the nuclear moment, the transition that's to the great accelerations, as Will Steffen would say, and the question is, again, without being a futurist per se, and some of those early slides I wouldn't let you read were about how hard it is to predict the future, impossible really. Is the EO technique, perhaps, is one step beyond Mumford, could be an era in which renewables and solar wind, this discussions that we saw graphed in the earlier paper, about the discussions about alternative energies. And the idea, one of the mottos being less is more, although we just had a long discussion about that, and we decided that certainly more is not more in many cases. Less is not always more. But what we decided was better is better. And having peak experiences. So best is best, and better is better. And that's the way I'm going to go forward with this. But the idea of, can there be a sustainable alternative energy? This is just a picture holder for that, an image of what we might expect and hope for coming out of the IPCC kind of discussions and the environmental movement. But there's alternatives, and Bernau really helps to remind us of that, the idea that there could be a biotechnic future in which a lot of things are genetically manipulated, including the genome. There could be a nanotech thing, and some of that can be new engineering, but also quite threatening. And there could also be a cybertech thing. So kind of the worst image of cybertech I could think of. But the idea of the singularity, the human, post-human future. So there's more futures on the table than just the eco-technic. And I forgot to say that eco-technic invokes the idea that we have to live within limits. We live in an ecosystem. We are primates that think a lot and primates that build a lot. We're Homo faber, Homo ludens. We play a lot. But also, we are technic, so we always will be building stuff. We do things. Humans make stuff. And the question is, what are we going to make in the future? And then the geotechnic, which I began to write about, but I'd like to go back to that. This is the geotechnologies it's kind of a standard stock image of iron fertilization, sulfate cannons, space mirrors, sequestering CO2, all kinds of kind of Rube Goldberg techniques to cool the planet. But I didn't see geoengineering coming up on that IPCC chart, but they are starting to talk about it in an AR5. Also, we tried to slay the term geoengineering because it's not engineering. Engineering requires a permit. Engineering would be reliable. Engineering requires that you cross a bridge safely every day. And so we're calling it climate intervention. And we're also not calling, this is a National Academy panel that I'm on in the US, but we're also not calling solar radiation management real management. The old SRM of solar radiation management is really albedo modification. It's not management. So I was very strong about arguing against the term engineering and management to apply to these things. And I hope it makes a difference. Then Bernau, he's really from about 1929, he wrote an essay. And again, you probably all read it, so maybe I'm just talking to the choir. But The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. And Bernau said, we've got to transcend this world. So he was a big advocate for moving away from the planet. If you can't live on it, the visionary people for Bernau were going to move off of it. And there might be a bifurcation in humanity where the real visionaries move to the spaceship Earth, and the contented the cultural cows live on Earth and are tended by the higher species. He was writing about this. He also talked about transcending the flesh. This is in 1929. He had more mechanistic ways to do it, but it was the age of electricity, and he came up with sort of Frankensteinian type metaphors for transcending the flesh. And then the devil is really not the biblical devil, but it's the devil of our psychological hang-ups. And here's where he talked about there might be a superior race who goes off to the outer space and in a utilitarian way harvests all of the energy of the sun and makes an ideal spacecraft and leaves the rest of humanity behind. I think that's all for Bernau, but the idea, I'll just quote a little Bernau to give you the flavor. Looking beyond the craft that's leaving the Earth itself, Bernau wrote, the stars cannot be allowed to continue in their old way, but will be turned into efficient heat engines. He's anticipating Heidegger's use of the term standing reserve. He turns the stars into standing reserve. Or Thoreau's idea of only the utilitarian value of the stars matter. Thoreau had talked about the utilitarian value of a forest, but now Bernal's talking about the utilitarian value of all energy. And we have to capture it for human use to be on hand, not just to be wasted as waste heat in the universe, but be called on for utilitarian ordering. This is the ultimate engineering control of the world, indeed the universe. And so there is literature on terraformation of other planets. The big problem with terraformation of this planet is there's all these people in the way. And if we go to Mars, we can just have free rein to pollute it and terraform it. Okay, so I did go to a meeting recently, not too recently, 2011, but it was called 100-Year Starship. It was funded by the U.S. Defense Department and NASA. And the idea was to leave the planet. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed von Neumann. Let's go to terraformation. They talked about leaving the planet on a spaceship, there was two tracks in the meeting. One was how to build the propulsion system, which included violating the second law of thermodynamics or going faster than the speed of light, or we got to get started now thinking this. So they had a prize competition to try to get ideas to make a spaceship to get away, because the Earth, if you're serious NASA futurist, or if you read a lot of sci-fi, you've got to get away from the planet to avoid big catastrophic events. Earth-shattering asteroids, degradation of the biosphere. You can't put all your human eggs in one basket, so you send some of them out colonizing. And there's a long literature on that. You know, Kim Stanley Robinson was at the meeting. They had a lot of scientists and sci-fi writers at the meeting. And it was just a wonderful playground for STS, for science technology studies, because of all the different ideas floating around. One physicist was really gonna violate the second law. But the group I stayed with mostly was how to build a biosphere, because this is Biosphere 2 in the Arizona desert. It failed in the 1990s for two reasons. It failed twice, once for technical reasons when the CO2 built up inside of it and the bionauts had to open up the door to Biosphere 1. So they got the nice fresh air from Arizona, and they retuned the thing, and they went back into the biosphere for a second mission without the propulsion. And they went into the biosphere to live peacefully inside of a closed sort of terrarium. And it failed for a second reason. That was human error. That was mutiny. That was the crew mutiny. The biosphere went into, they had a financial problem, and the management collapsed. And the bionauts that didn't get to go on the second mission kind of broke the airlock for the people that were inside. So one could be technical or one could be social reasons for failing to make a biosphere. And if you were on a spaceship and had a failure in your biosphere, you know, nobody can hear you scream in space, and there's no Biosphere 1 to support you. So one of the big tasks is to make a functioning biosphere if you're going to make a or if you're going to even model the Earth. If you can't model the biosphere, you can't predict its future. That's prediction is really what's the sine qua non here. If you can't predict the future status of your biosphere, you're not going to do a very good job with the climate system of the Earth. And so the biosphere is a metaphor. It was turned into a drylands grass research institute by the University of Arizona now. And on the way, it was proposed to be kind of a retirement home for people. Kind of, they would sell off condos in the biosphere or near the biosphere. So it doesn't have a current viable functioning. Although there are wonderful NASA engineers who will take almost every drop of water on the International Space Station and reuse it. So they get up to 99.9% of the water reuse, because if they don't, they would have to send more water up. It's very heavy, it's very expensive. So there's good people working on water recycling, but we don't have all the other things that we would need to make a closed biosphere. Now, I guess I can say something about von Neumann, because he asked, my paper was out of whack with the slides, but von Neumann asked in 1955 in a big public article, he said, can we survive technology? He lived in the middle of the nuclear age. We're still in the nuclear age, but he lived in a particularly tense time. And he also was involved in climate control in the 1950s. And he said two things could happen. One would be nuclear proliferation, and the other could be actual success at climate control, global climate control. And that would be worse in some ways, for his opinion, than nuclear problems. It would put every nation into every other nation's business and probably trigger some real antipathy. And so von Neumann, I sort of turned von Neumann. He said we can get by with patience, flexibility, intelligence, humility, dedication, oversight, sacrifice, and a healthy dose of good luck. And it looks like we had some good luck circa 1962 when we didn't blow up the planet over the Cuban Missile Crisis. But we could also say, in turning von Neumann's title a little bit around, we can say, can we survive without technology? And then you have to ask what kind of technology, because it alludes to the fact that we are Homo faber, we're the primates who make stuff. And so then I'm going to, what can we say about the future? Well, we can say that we've definitely got to get out of the Pleistocene. Now we've got to get out of the paleotechnic idea that coal and oil and the mass consumption, mass production is going to bring social order and happiness, and whatever else it says up there, we've got to do those things. You guys can, again, you can read faster than I could talk. And it's just about lunchtime for me, so I'm going to let you read. I'm going to let you read it. I do have a little epilogue. Do I have a moment? I'm trying to go through. This is the potential cover of my new book. And I'm going to go back into this neotechnic seriously, the 1900 and 1960 period. And I call it Everything Atmospheric Everywhere Always, but with the subtitle of Entrepreneurs of Atmospheric Research 1900-1960. And I was just dying to get to Paris because I wanted to ask about the word entrepreneur. It's Middle English. I know entrepreneur is French. And I don't know about entrepreneur, so that's a topic for later discussion. With the O-U-R, it's like the difference between playing an oboe and a French horn. This is or, O-U-R. And the entrepreneur is a public-minded entrepreneur. It's people, I have some scientists as examples, Wilhelm Bjerknes, Carl Rossby, and Harry Wexler, and they spent their money on paying their assistants and getting cooperation to look at the Earth as a three-dimensional object. And they were doing the three-dimensionality through radio waves and through the airplane and through the rockets and through the satellite systems. They couldn't do it themselves. And they didn't build the technology to build atmospheric science. They used consumer technologies, the radio, even in a way the television cameras on Tyros, the rocketry that was all built for other reasons. You know, the V2 was built by Hitler for nefarious reasons, but the V2 became the first sounding rockets for the upper space exploration. So that's why I'm writing a history of science and technology. And it goes, here's Marconi. There's an airplane outfitted with a little meteorograph. It's a little graphing instrument on the wing. And Rossby and his gang looking at the meteorograph. Rossby was a bon vivant and a kind of a center of the seminar, Swedish charismatic guy who built the MIT program. He built the Chicago program, and then he built the Stockholm program in atmospheric science. And the radio sonde was a big technology, probably the origin of remote sensing in one way, because you can't get the information down by long wires going up. You don't have to bring the balloon back down. You get the telemetry. And telemetry becomes a critical part of the space age as well as the propulsion. The radar developed in World War II for defense purposes, but they found it would bounce off of hydrometeors as well. And it would be a remote sensing technology to look at the planet. The V2, outfitted with cameras and instruments, extended our three-dimensionality. Torricelli said we live at the bottom of an ocean of atmosphere, but now we live more in it and through it, and there's all kinds of airplane travel and and there's radio waves, and so the atmosphere became a three-dimensional object, and the program was to the program was to try to get the three-dimensional measurements so that the laws of physics could be applied to them so that the perfect forecast could come out. This was Bjerknes' program. You measure nature precisely, you know the laws of physics, you apply those laws, and you get a result, which is the future. So if a cosmologist looked to the origin of the universe and other, you know, kind of the brain people look to the origin of consciousness and stuff, then these guys were looking into sort of a time machine. What's the world going to be like 7 days from now, eventually 10, 30? They hope they could do, the climate people hope they can do 100 years now. That's what we were getting as far as a claim from that group, 2100. Anyway, the program was very Laplacian, as I said earlier, but it was tempered by Poincaré's notion that you can't measure nature precisely. So that when the program was formulated, what Bjerknes said, we need sufficiently accurate measurements to make a sufficiently accurate forecast. He added the adjective sufficiently, which was his sort of acknowledgement to the lectures he had heard from Poincaré in 1900. The bomb is, that horizon that lays down the radioactive layer on the Earth. That is one of those moments for the potential beginning of the Anthropocene, but it's also a tool that brought radioactive tracers and the idea of trajectories of fallout that served the purposes of the atmospheric scientists. So nuclear power certainly didn't start in 1945, it started in 1895. And so there's a first atomic age of X-rays and all that stuff, and this age actually fueled the theories of the ecologists and the atmospheric scientists, because here's a case of, this was a bomb detonation over the Soviet Union, and they were trying to see if the Soviet Union was setting off their bombs on occasions when the index cycle was very high, and when the Rossby waves would have brought that debris across the U.S., and they discovered that they didn't think it was true. This debris really got across Canada. And so there was a Cold War dimension to all this as well. Their digital computer is often framed as the sine qua non, the holy grail, the promised land of the 20th century meteorology, because now you could solve those equations quickly and digitally. But there's much more to it than that. And so there's some books about computing and being the holy land. But it's all these aerospace and communication and nuclear technologies put together, including the first view of the Earth from an Arabes rocket showed a photograph of a tropical storm, and then Harry Wexler's produced by Sebastian, and I forgot to hype his book, but he gave me a copy of it, and I hope you know his new book, which is a wonderful title. Was what? The Earth Seen from Above. I hope you all get a copy. And Harry Wexler had commissioned this idea in 1954, before the International Geophysical Year, of what the world might look like from outer space. And here we have storms, we have, I guess I have a pointer, we have trade winds in the tropics, we have stratus off of California. Of course, U.S. is in the middle here because he's a U.S. scientist, and he had that commission. This painting hangs in Washington, D.C. It's owned by the Smithsonian. And there's a little nascent hurricane off Puerto Rico. And the nascent is important because they hoped that they could find these hurricanes by using Tyros before they grew up, and then they could bomb them, and they could try to tear them apart with ordnance, and they could shoot the hurricanes. I'm winding up. Then comes the IGY. This is the moment in which they launched the Soviets launched Sputnik, and the U.S. launched the Explorer series. And the Explorer series, illustrated here, discovered the magnetosphere of the Earth. This is from the blackboard at University of Iowa, 1958. Delta, the fourth satellite, space is radioactive. And so if space is radioactive, the military is going to be interested in it. And the first instrument that ever flew on a real first instrument and satellite had an instrument called a Geiger counter because it was counting. There was a theory that the Earth's magnetic field could be used as an attack. This is Nicholas Christofilos saying, well, the Earth has these magnetic fields, and if you set up a bomb in the Indian Ocean, the electromagnetic force would come across and make an EMP over Moscow. That was his lecture, to make a half a world death ray using the magnetosphere. So the first thing to do when you discover something in science is to blow it up or to dissect it or to do something with it. And there's what I promised Sebastian, I'd bring a Keeling curve with me. This is Harry Wexler, who set up Keeling on Mauna Loa. And the year of his death, which was Wexler's death, was 62. Keeling already knew that there was an annual cycle and there was an upward trend in the data. And in 62, Keeling became pretty much an environmental spokesman. I'm going to end there. There's Wexler with the Tyros satellite. I went to visit this just last week on the coast of New Jersey. It's the satellite dish that brought the data down from the Tyros satellite, and then they helicoptered it down to Eisenhower. And this dish still stands there. Ham radio operators are using it. They've refurbished it. And it's my symbol for connecting the electromagnetic side of the story with the space side of the story. There's a final slide, which is the Earth from Tyros images showing the polar vortex in both photographic and in sort of Bergen analyses. And this was not just a scientific accomplishment, but the caption said it leads to the World Weather Watch, which is still going on today. So that's WWW before the internet. Now, what I've tried to do by conclusion is imagine technocultures, big picture framings, and the big picture framings can be macro historical, as was first illustrated, you know, by Mumford, but they can also be areas of historical intervention where you can look at the details of the macro history, frame it, and tell stories about warm-blooded, real-life protagonists and real developments that lead to the modern atmospheric scientists. And in 1960, this whole program, Laplacian program, hit the wall that I talked about, the chaos limit. So we're currently, maybe that's the best timing for the Anthropocene. We're living in a world of attempted certainty, but coming into a world of not complete chaos, but of chaotic behavior. If we don't have time to go into that. But I hope I've given you some big things to think about, some things that we could definitely discuss in larger context, and maybe it fuels your current thinking about colored images of the IPCC. Thank you very much for your attention.